Blog Talk Radio.
Peace, 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 everyone. This is Keith Young, and this is Afro Perspectives Radio. And we represent the School of Secrets. What we're going to be talking about today is Black consciousness and the state of mental health in the Black community. And I find that this is an all too overlooked portion of the things that we have going on in our communities that we don't pay enough attention to or give enough credit to dealing with because that it causes a lot of problems. And we're starting to see a lot more problems in our community splash out into the mainstream when it comes to seeing high profile Black celebrities like Kid Cudi and Kanye West dealing very publicly with their battles with their own mental health crisis as it deals with depression, paranoia, and drug abuse. So tonight, I have a special guest that's waiting in the queue. Her name is Patrice Lucas of Coffee with a Counselor, and we're going to be discussing these Black mental health issues, and we're going to explore how our mental health is tied to our state of consciousness. And then we're also going to be discussing how does post-traumatic slave syndrome exist and what is it? And then we're also going to discuss Americans suffering from trauma due to racism and police brutality. So let's get into it. I believe I have my co-host on the line. Let me see if I can bring her in. Peace.
Hello,
this is the last four digits is 6291. This is Patrice.
Yes, it is. How are you tonight?
Hello.
Hello.
I'm good.
Hear
how are you?
Good, thank you.
I can hear you very well.
Awesome.
All right. So tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Thank you. So again, Patrice Lucas, and I'm a licensed mental health counselor, and I am a master's level mental health counselor here in the state of Michigan. So what that means, I obtained a master's degree in mental health counseling, and then I became licensed to be able to provide services to my clients here in Michigan. And at this time, I work at my own private practice called Indigo Transitions, where the biggest tenet of my work is I meet my clients where they are. So what that looks like is I go to my clients physically and spiritually and mentally as well. I meet them on their journey. But I really step into my work in a powerful way, and I like to call myself a communities counselor because I don't hold myself apart from the community. I'm still very active in social media and different community programs and different community settings, et cetera. So I'm really a reachable and attainable to my clients, but also my community at large. And I think that's a really unique place that I hold as a counselor because I don't see a lot of other mental health professionals doing it. But I see it as so absolutely necessary to break down the stigmas. As a part of that, I created a social advocacy program called Coffee with a Counselor. And that's literally where I go in the community and I have coffee, do cocoa circles, coffee circles, workshops, anything or any place where groups gather, I'll go and I'll talk about mental health awareness. Or, you know, the group may provide me with a topic that they want, either their students or their church members or their family members, et cetera, to talk about. And we talk about those challenges that people may face. I provide education, awareness, intervention, prevention, resources, solutions about mental health into the community. I chose to do it from a Coffee with a Counselor perspective because I think, you know, the mental health challenges, and we talked a little bit about this, is so large in our communities that individual counseling or even just traditional group counseling is not enough. We really need to have social group counseling to be able to meet the needs of our people and really to train each other, those who are not dealing with mental health challenges, to be able to identify them and offer support and assistance to their friends and family. Did I cover everything?
So, that covered quite a bit. And I'm glad that you cover so much. I do have a question.
Okay.
Your social group counseling, are you saying that you're dealing with counseling from a group dynamic, so you do this for groups, or is this for individuals?
So my private practice is both, really. So my private practice, I like to say I work with individuals from the cradle to the grave, and I see really anybody in the family. So that may mean I may work with parents of newborns, and I may help them to kind of adjust to being parents or gain some better skills to be parents. But I also work with the toddlers and the school-age children, all the way really up to, I do a lot of work in grief and loss. I do a lot of work in caregiver support. And I also work with a lot of clients transitioning, or they may be at the end of their life cycle. I work with a lot of oncology clients in that space where I assist them with accepting the dying process because they may be terminal in their illness. So really, cradle to the grave is where I work from an individual practice perspective. I see individuals, couples, families, and also do group work as well. My social advocacy program, Coffee with a Counselor, is just group work. So I meet with any groups that want to host me. It's completely funded with personal funding from the Indigo Transition practice, and support and funding from the community or sponsorships from the community, any grant monies or different things like that, fundraising, et cetera, sponsors the Coffee with a Counselor workshops, cocoa circles, coffee circles, et cetera. And in that space, I work with groups. I do it on a social basis, so it's not always traditional groups. And when I say traditional groups, a lot of times in mental health counseling, you have certain support groups, but they don't have they do have somewhat of a social component, but it's still you coming to someone else's facility to have the services or have the group, and I go and I come to you with both my individual practice and with the Coffee with the Counselor. So I come to you in the community. So I really socialize the work that I do in an attempt to. I think it, and I really honestly think it's doing a lot of work, at least here in the Detroit area, and breaking down the stigma of mental health. Okay.
I see. Now, you mentioned that you do both.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, do you find that a lot of other mental health professionals kind of see themselves as not being a part of the community? They kind of set themselves apart from that?
Well, I see that to be true both professionally and personally as someone. So I one of the things I do with my clients in my community, I disclose. So I've actually had counseling myself. I think it's a necessary step for anyone that is counseling you or your therapist or psychologist or whomever you're seeking services from. They should have had the services themselves. So that's part of, what I share with my clients as well. But so personally and professionally, I do observe that most clinicians in mental health hold themselves apart from the community. Not all, but a large majority. And the reason that is so is, again, on some level based on the stigma. And it is a lot of times based on some of the confidentiality concerns, the boundaries we need to adhere to in terms of our ethical guidelines, and additionally for our own safety reasons. So they want to have this autonomous perspective. A lot of practices, a lot of theories, a lot of modalities in mental health believe that the client should see the counselor as someone that they can kind of trust and believe in. And a lot of times when people feel that can only be gained through the client seeing them as whole or completely healthy or having figured it all out or, it's kind of the old saying where you want to go to a doctor who's practicing what they are telling me to practice. But we know that to not to be true in the medical health professor, you know. I mean, I hear stories all the time about the dentist with the stinky breath kind of thing, right? But in the mental health because there's such stigma, they still feel like they have to hold themselves to this higher standard than their clients. It's more above human standard than their clients, so the clients can trust in their ability to work with them. And I find just the opposite. Again, part of me meeting my clients where they are is I truly meet them on their journey, and I let them know very intimately and from a place of vulnerability that, you know, a lot of times for my clients, I'm that person that's saying, me too, meaning I've experienced something similar, me too, I struggle too. And I think that's so important, and that's not present enough in mental health. And I think I've seen that both professionally and personally.
I see. I know I had an experience that was very off-putting. I was looking for some mental health counseling, and I was given a number by a friend to call a psychologist. And, you know, before I even said hello, you know, she said, so your insurance doesn't take care of, you know, sitting down and talking about, you know, regular mental health issues. So that means you're going to have to pay out of pocket. If you're going to pay out of pocket, it's going to be, you know, she started going all into the financial aspect of it before I even said hello or could even ascertain whether or not this person could really help me.
Absolutely.
So that was very off-putting, you know, to me. So I definitely find that your way of interacting with people and talking with them is much more open, and it comes from a more honest place where it's like, you know, I actually want to help you. Like, money is secondary. Of course, it's necessary, but it's not like you open up the conversation talking about the cost. And I find that, you know, some mental health professionals tend to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that. And you know, so I don't want to downplay, you know, the need for mental health or that some mental health professionals do it. The reality is that most professionals do it. And here's the reason why, right? Because we have lawyers that do the same thing. We have medical doctors that kind of do the same thing. We have tax people who do the same thing. You know, I can just name all the different professions that do the same thing. And again, my journey to mental health, I was 16 years in corporate America. My undergrad is computer science. And what that afforded me is to just kind of live a really rich life. Rich life before I became a mental health counselor. And so when I decided to go back to my passion and kind of, I believe, what is my life's calling, I took the opportunity to kind of observe other business owners and their practices. And what I found was many of them were what I like to call, you know how people say house broke? Someone is house broke, if they are broke because of their house. Most professionals are broke because of their offices, right? So I really, and it, again, this is why I do not have a brick and mortar location, because I never wanted seeing a client to be based on me having to pay rent, right? And that be my primary focus. Oh, let me get enough of these clients in here to pay the monthly rent, to pay the utilities, to pay for this beautiful office that I have created for myself. Not to say that I'm not going to get there and not have a beautiful office, but I really want to do it the right way. I didn't want to get the beautiful office and then start looking for clients to pay for that beautiful office, if that makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense.
And I think that happens.
It makes a lot of sense. It definitely helps me to understand where people are coming from.
Yeah, and I think that I don't know 100% for sure, but I know I see that too often. I have seen, and I've had opportunities to work with other professionals, like I said, lawyers, et cetera. And when I go into a bare bones office, right, and I'm not looking at these amazing, not to say that you can't get amazing service in those places. What I'm saying is most often I get better service in the bare bones office because they really are kind of meeting me where I am, and they're not worried about, you know, paying for this, you know, $2,500 desk. They're just kind of want to do this work. And I, again, I'm not putting down people with beautiful offices. I actually have, you know, last year I worked in an amazing, beautiful office in West Bloomfield, and we do amazing work out of that office. So it's not to say you can't do both. It's just you have to decide when the best timing is to do it, and, you know, really be honest with yourself and truthful with yourself of whether or not, you know, what's your end goal. Is it to pay for the beautiful office or to, you know, help your client, help your community?
I see. All right, so let's switch gears just a little bit, if that's okay. I would like to talk about how we as a community, when I say we, I mean the Black community, or Moorish or Hebrew Israelite or Kemetic or whatever you want to call it, how is it that you find a lot of us see mental health or talking about mental health? Is that something that, you know, we kind of have a stigma about that we're not dealing with, or do you see more people being open about their issues and needing help with that?
So from the beginning of when I start kind of really paying attention to mental health, I come from a family that is really rooted in mental illness and saw a lot of mental health services, from everything from anxiety disorder to substance abuse to schizophrenia. So I had a lot of opportunity to kind of be in these mental health spaces and to kind of see the shift that I feel like is truly happening. So there was a time we didn't talk about mental health at all. I wouldn't even have been able to kind of get someone to invite me to talk on their blog talk radio show about it, right? But we are making some strides, but there is still a huge stigma related to mental health and mental illness in the Black community, and we're not having enough conversations about it. You know, one of the things I say about Coffee with a Counselor, I want to make conversations about mental health as common as buying a cup of coffee, because it just has to be. And I say it just has to be because it's really costing us, many of us our lives. So there is definitely a stigma. And it comes from, you know, I know a lot of times people don't, you know, there's some stigma associated with relating the African experience in the Americas and across the globe to slavery and colonization. But a lot of what we experience is rooted in that. And I know we're going to talk about that a lot more later. But essentially, you know, during the, slave trade and during slavery, the valuable slaves, right, the ones that were considered big and strong or smart and valuable or smart and useful were the ones that got the best treatment, right? So if you had either physical conditions or mental conditions where you couldn't produce for the master, then you were given or received more inhumane treatment. You receive more beatings and you receive more abuse. So over time, strength became equivalent to survival. And so that is still perpetrated today, right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to be, you don't, you know, because we didn't have that opportunity since the very beginning of us here in this place to be able to say, I'm hurt, I'm sick, I'm weak, I can't, I'm not today. We haven't learned the language to be able to say those things now. We haven't learned to be able to talk about it and say it now. Because our strength, our health, is rooted directly in our survival. And I would like to say that is still now, right? When you think about mental health or physical health for individuals and the need to take time off, take a day off, take a moment to pause and catch your breath. A lot of times as African Americans, we don't feel like we have that opportunity to do so. in our day-to-day struggles, in our day-to-day challenges, et cetera. You know, we really are the first generation, I believe, and I've said this, I share this with my clients quite often, that we're the first generation of Africans in America that have the luxury of kind of thinking about our feelings and emotions. I can remember as a small girl being told all the time, you better put your feelings in your back pocket. And that was rooted in the need to survive.
You know, it's so interesting. You know, what you just shared is so, it is. And you're right. It comes from our history. It comes from slavery and colonialism. And, you know, I remember, you know, being smacked in the face and then told to not show it, you know, after someone has just devastated your whole personal, you know, invaded your space. You know, I can remember my face getting flushed, my stomach filled up with butterflies, and the tears are coming, and they're like, you bet not cry, you know. And that was, you know, still a vestige from slavery when you had to take your licks and keep it moving, you know, and there was nothing to be done for it. So, you know, what you're saying is so correct.
But, it, you know, today we can't even say that this is a vestige from slavery, you know, because as a African-American male, you get pulled over by the police. What do you What do you have to do? You can't show any emotion surrounding that scenario. You know, as an African-American woman, and, you know, when I used to work in corporate America, and I would be, you know, whatever, pick something in the office, I didn't have the luxury to show my true feelings about something because, as you know, I would be labeled as the angry black woman. Right? So that's still present today for us. It's just kind of changed, right? How that is kind of, you know, beat into us, I guess I would use that language, is different, but it's still present. It's still present. It's reinforced, I guess.
Yeah.
The messages are still reinforced. They haven't went away.
So when I started to... Well, so when I started to learn about African history and consciousness, I learned about something called post-traumatic slave syndrome. And it was something that I learned about studying the work of Dr. Amos Wilson and a few other of our prominent mental health professionals, one who just passed away, Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, and they were speaking about this post-traumatic slave syndrome as being a part of the reason why, to go back to what you were saying, we feel the way we feel when confronted with police. We feel some type of way when we deal with stress on the job. And it's behind a lot of the reasons why we have things like sexual dysfunction, molestation and rape rampant in our families, depression and paranoia that that we deal with on a day-to-day basis that we don't know how to deal with, that we kind of just, like you said, kind of fold it up and put it in your back pocket and keep soldiering on. And so when I read those things, it was kind of a revelation to me because it made me really start to think about, why do I do the things that I do? Why do I discipline my children the way that I discipline them? Why do I yell, or why do I grab for a belt, or why do I, you know, think about these things when that may not be have been our indigenous way of handling discipline or stress or even issues surrounding sexuality. And so can you speak to that a little bit?
Absolutely. And you're absolutely right. And you mentioned quite a few of the same individuals that I studied as well. And including, and I'm not sure I pronounced her name right, but she actually wrote a book called Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, Dr. Joy DeGruy. Is it DeGruy? I think you're probably familiar with her. And she really talks about the She explains how the effects of slavery and institutional racism, and she continues the conversation that was started before her by the individuals that you mentioned, but it continues to show up in African Americans today. She uses a really key example that I think is really powerful as to why it's kind of still showing up. And one of the reasons it's still showing up is because we don't have the conversations about racism and institutionalized racism and slavery and all these things that is continuing to happen for us. And she talks about this idea of truthfulness as being the gateway to, you know, really self-actualization, to be able to grow as human beings, and to be able to kind of master self and be healed and be healthy, this level of truthfulness. But we never can speak from a place of truthfulness as it relates to, you know, slavery and institutionalized racism. That's never part of the conversation. So it's absolutely still present today. There's arguments. There was this really interesting NPR article last year, July of last year, that talked about the title of the article was called Coping While Black. So not only do we have this post-traumatic slavery syndrome that is still present with us today, where we have all these learned behaviors and these learned generational traumas that we continue to replay over and over and over again, and that is still played on us, such as Jim Crow, and now, you know, the food to prison pipeline, and the disparities in the justice system, et cetera, police brutality, all the things that is happening to us now that is still traumatizing, right? So there's not just the trauma that occurs to us in slavery, but the traumas that we see every day, not only from the larger community and oppression, but also within our community as well. So all the traumas we experience are taking a psychological toll on us, including those from slavery, right? And there's new research being done. It's actually being done on individuals, Jewish people from the, you know, that have descendants or ancestors that survived the Holocaust, and they're isolating different genes that shows that there's a presence of genes where there's genetic imprint, basically, that happens over time that's carried into the gene pool because of the traumatic experiences that occurred historically with your descendants of those in the concentration camps or slaves as well. And so there's that idea as well, that there's a trauma creates a physical change in the individuals and is present in the genes of the individuals. So think about it. You know, when we think about, you know, individual Jewish people, right? The article that I read about that spoke about this as it related to Holocaust descendants, it talks about how from the perspective of Jewish people, like a kind of a stereotype or a kind of common thing that they, when we think about Jewish people, is that they're kind of anxious. They're kind of nervous, high energy type of individuals. And they link that back to this kind of idea that most or generally Jewish people are this type of way, kind of really anxious type of people, anal type of individuals. They linked it back to the trauma experience in the Holocaust, where it was, you know, clearly a high anxiety and you're very anxious and you don't know, you know, whether this thing that you're experiencing is going to be life or death, survival. That those same theories can be applied to slavery as well. And what happens is we're very ancient creatures, and our brains are amazingly designed, right? And is an amazing organ that serves us very well in theory, but it doesn't serve us very well based on where we are right now socially. So what that means is that every memory we have what's called instant recall of the memory. So every experience you have today will be experienced unless you very quickly work to control it based on the previous experiences that you've had. right? An example of that, if I started singing the happy birthday song right now,
mm-hmm.
you would recall, very instantly, you would recall memories about the happy birthday song. And depending on whether they were pleasurable memories or good memories, for most people it's good memories, you would have a physiological response to that. You would start thinking and kind of sense that that is about to happen. You're about to have some joy or pleasure or some goodness associated with the song. Similarly, if I start singing, for a lot of people, the Amazing Grace song, again, you're having a physiological reaction. You're remembering a time when you experienced that song and it was maybe sad for you, or during a funeral service or a church service, et cetera. And those are the memories that's going to come back. And your body basically, your mind at first, and then your body begins to prepare for what you remember associated with that song or that smell or that experience or that feeling. Does that make sense?
Makes a lot of sense.
Right. So that's where
it makes all the sense in the world, especially given the fact that no, go ahead.
Oh, so that's kind of where that's kind of describes
hello
what happens during. I'm sorry. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
I can hear you very well. Can you hear me?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I can hear you.
So that's kind of what happens, or the, you know, a little generalized idea of what happens during post-traumatic syndrome, or when you have post-traumatic disorder. And it kind of, it's just basically the memories of the trauma you experience. When those memories happen again, you experience as if they were the original trauma. So from an African-American experience, we experience many traumas really every day. You know, the argument is there that there is trauma in institutionalized racism.
Mm-hmm.
And what that looks like is...
So my next segue then is... The next segue then is about that trauma and recalling the trauma based on that fear or that trauma that was created during slavery. So one of the things that I learned about slavery was that, you know, they looked at us like chattel or cattle or horses. They, you know, they often refer to us as studs and heifers and things like that. And so they applied many of the same tactics to getting their livestock to behave. They would apply some of the same tactics to us as human beings, like buck breaking. They would take the biggest and strongest of us and break us down so that we were the most subservient, so that those who were weaker and not as strong as those that we looked up to would see, you know, this big, huge, hulking person be brought down. And we could see, well, okay, if they couldn't make it, or if they couldn't stand up to this punishment from this person who has enslaved us, then surely I can't. So it became a part of the culture to molest us, to rape us, and to do those things on purpose, with the idea that, you know, if the parents are afraid of this criminal who is enslaving us, then the children would be as well. And so that speaks to what you were just talking about as far as that study they were doing with Jewish people and how fear can actually be transmitted genetically. Is that what you were saying? Or am I making a clear connection by saying that fear can be transmitted genetically?
Absolutely. Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. So there's an idea that there's, in epigenology, when they study epigenology, that you see there is certain genes in certain populations of people that is present because of the traumas that they've experienced. they yet to really begin studying slavery from this perspective, but they absolutely have started studying it from a Holocaust perspective. So if you Google epigenealogy and trauma or anxiety or depression, you'll get a host of articles and a host of research that kind of speaks to this idea. So you have it exactly right.
So then we're just going to keep daisy chaining these ideas together, like the recalling of trauma to kind of put you in place or put you in check, at least from the standpoint of colonialism or being able to have a population that's easily controlled. One of the ways that I find that we as people tend to get our memories refreshed about slavery and about those things that happened, the trauma in specific and the fear, is through the books that we are given to read and the movies that we are given to watch as it relates to slavery and the Holocaust, the worst parts of slavery. So some of the books that our children are forced to read in elementary, middle, and high school have to do with slavery. So I had to read books like, you know, The Color Purple, To Kill a Mockingbird, and Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry, the Harriet Tubman. And, you know, I got to actually, so in my mind, while I'm reading these books, I'm experiencing all the trauma and disrespect and fear that all of those enslaved people had to feel during their particular time. Now, I never experienced slavery directly, but through my genetics, you know, that's being rekindled inside of me by actually going over those old accounts and then in my mind recreating the scene. And we're talking about your mind. So your mind is a very powerful thing, and your mind, you know, builds worlds for you. Based on how your mind is configured, you're either looking at the world with a positive outlook or a negative outlook. And I found that a lot of the movies, you know, especially today, they're still doing them. It's like 2016. They're still doing movies about slavery, 12 Years a Slave, you know, The Help. You know, they're still doing these movies that are based around our trauma and not around our triumph. And it's not a whole lot of people that I see catching on to that. It's like they're linking. There's something called a mnemonic device. A mnemonic device is a way to latch memories onto you, to make you to continue to remember them. And so nobody's looking at these movies or books as being these memory devices that are triggering our genetic fears and psychoses. And I often wonder about that.
Well, it's no different than no one is studying kind of some of the things that we do in our communities that is not is absent from other communities. Like, I've always wondered if they did a large-scale study on the chemicals and the chemical processing of our hair, et cetera. No one's doing that study because it's not mainstream enough, right? That's why the studies that do talk about epigenealogy as it relates to anxiety and fear are going on. Jewish individuals, they're probably funding their own studies. We are not. But we really first have to start having the conversations about it. And I know you do an amazing job about really bringing it up to the forefront and really sharing about how media specifically shapes our thoughts and our behaviors and who we believe ourselves to be. So one of the things I didn't share, I kind of skirted past it, but I'm a cognitive behavioral therapist. That's the base of my work. And so I know that you are who you think you are. And so if things in the media, so if you, like you said, if they're triggering with some of these books and these media images, et cetera, and these movies, et cetera, are not only our genealogy from those traumatic times, but they're also triggering our own memories. So even if you didn't experience slavery, but the person on the screen looks like you, and you experience trauma, because I don't think you can be alive in America and really hasn't experienced trauma, particularly as an African alive in America, right? So with that being said, your own trauma experience is now going to be coupled with the trauma experience that is slavery. And so when you're experiencing and watching those memories, you're and you become uncomfortable. Let's just call it that. Let's say you begin to react to what you're seeing on the screen. You're also, your brain, because it's so smart, is having these recall memories and really putting you in a place of fight or flight. So you're releasing all of these chemicals in your body as if you are truly in danger, right? So there's a lot of things that we do that are not healthy for us, including watching and do anything that produces inauthentic experiences of fear, right? So this produces inauthentic experience of fight or flight, flight or my apologies, but you understand what I'm saying. The fight or flight, sorry.
Fight or flight, the fight or flight response.
Fight or flight, yes.
Absolutely.
Respond. So these movies not only stimulate that, but there are some other things that we do. So, you know, it's not just historical settings of movies, right? We can look at the big bad gentleman that was Eric Garner, right? Or Trayvon Martin, or Tamir Rice, right? So it's not just the big bad ones that they take down in front of us and say, look, we took him down, we can take you down too. They also manipulate and hurt our children, right? Or separate the mothers from their children, which was another part of that whole psychology of look what we can do to you, look how we can hurt you. And it is demoralizing. And it does put you in a state of fear, right? In a constant state of fear that I have no control over my own life and I'm not worthy. And
As
a mother, I begin to feel like I can't protect my own children. So what does that do to me as a mother? What does that do to my self-esteem? As a man, I can't protect my own children or myself or my wife or my community. So what does that do to my self-esteem? As a mental health counselor, I have had the opportunity to observe that esteem.
Absolutely.
Right? That esteem is really the undercurrent to all the mental health challenges that people experience. Even if they're chemical imbalances, their esteem of self-esteem impacts their outcomes as it relates to those chemical imbalances. Even in physical health as well, because a lot of the work I do is with I do mental health with a lot of patients that have physical illness challenges. And so their outcomes, their positive outcomes or negative outcomes are directly related to what they think about themselves.
Okay. So now we come to a really good place to segue again with the idea that if you can change your mind or your consciousness, you can change your circumstances. That's a quote from Dr. Amos Wilson. And I kind of want to unpack that idea about, you know, the circumstances that we as a community find ourselves being in, being in depressed economically depressed areas or being gentrified out of urban areas and things of that nature, not having the type of culture or not having the same types of access, and then being able to change that. A big part of being able to change your environment comes from the ability to change your mind. So how do we get to a place where we're looking at ourselves from a constructive point of view so that we can start to change our environment constructively?
Right. I think the first thing you have to do is recognize that what is, again, kind of back to the whole idea of truthfulness. You really do have to really find your own truth, whatever really that is for you. And I think it's seeking truth. Right, and really beginning to ask yourself. And I think, you know, I have small children. Well, I have a preteen and teen now, but to me, I still see them as small children. But, you know, I see this very organically in our children, that they begin to question the world around them. We all do, even up into adulthood, or even up into the advanced ages, even at the stage of end of life, we are still questioning the world around us. And so those questions that we have, why is this happening to us? Why was that young man killed? Why did we elect, you know, someone that was a, you know, openly racist and openly bigoted and openly against so many things that we say as a country we're, you know, against or for? When we start questioning what's kind of going on and we start seeking truth and seeking knowledge is where the kind of the idea would start from being able to heal not only ourselves but also our community. So when my clients come to me, they are in a place of saying, you know what, I'm not comfortable. I'm not comfortable with my life the way that it is right now, and I want more for my life, and here's what's going on. And like you said, I help them unpack kind of what's happening and what's going on to them and help them gain awareness and help them see their thoughts and their core beliefs about themselves and their community and their family and this social construct is limiting them.
So by them starting to seek the truth about the situation, you find that helps them to start to deconstruct these artificial constructs, if you will, like the basic, you know, once again, Amos Wilson, he wrote a whole book on the falsification of African consciousness, which basically talks about how we've been given an artificial consciousness and an artificial way to look at the world based on that of our oppressor, opposed to the way that we traditionally would have seen it and have been able to use our own psychological constructs to sort of create a way out of our problems, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And for me, I think it's present. I think it's present for some. It's just, it's really being
brave enough.
So my
question is, No, go ahead. I think we have a little lag where I'm talking and then it takes a while for it to transmit, so that's okay. Go ahead and answer.
You were saying your question was, but I was saying, you know, kind of where you left that off is that we have it's really being brave enough to kind of do the work to explore and really begin to ask for more for ourselves and believe that we have a right to ask for more. Very recently, I kind of started observing this generation that a lot of our children are now part of this generation of this entitlement generation. And I had this aha moment really just a week ago, just listening to my own children, some of the other children in the community, children across the globe. And with this sense of entitlement, I really feel like we have a generation of African-American children, Africans in the entire, you know, across the globe, that really believe, right, a generation of girls and women even, that really believe that they are entitled to what this world has to offer them. Whereas we didn't have that belief system. I didn't grow up really believing, you know, I believe that I could get a lot out of this world, but I didn't believe I could get everything out of it. And I see in my children that they really believe that they can have absolutely anything that they want. And I didn't have that. So I think we're on the cusp of that new generation of kind of awakening and dawning and this belief system that, hey, I can have everything that I want. And I think as those roadblocks, the same roadblocks that they're, you know, their forefathers experienced, their parents experienced, et cetera, they're going to meet them differently than we did. I think they're going to meet them with a sense of entitlement, like, wait a minute, okay, I see you're trying to put up this roadblock for me, but no, I'm entitled to this, and they're going to fight for it differently than we are. But it's a kind of knowingness. They almost didn't pay attention to the slave movies. They didn't pay attention to the rhetoric. They didn't pay attention, or wasn't taught, maybe, I'm not sure, I haven't done all that research, to some of the things that was kind of ingrained into us about who we were and what we could be. And I think that is what is going to be freeing for them.
Yeah. Awesome. So with all that being said, I would like you to share how it is that people can reach you and avail themselves of your services, and, you know, just kind of reach out to see if, you know, working with you would be a good fit.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that. So again, I can be reached at my private practice, which is Indigo Transitions. And I do individual counseling, cradle to the grave, for every member of the family and the family unit, couples as well. And I can also be reached for my social advocacy program, Coffee with a Counselor. I can be reached either via email, which is Patrice, and that's Patrece_Lucas, Lucas, @att.net. And, you know, I have people all the time that just kind of email me questions, et cetera. And I can also be reached by phone at 248-957-1721. And again, you kind of talked about this in the beginning, but the way that I kind of do my work is I call, and I really do free consultations with everyone who calls me. And even if my services don't meet your need because of the way I want to work and the way I want to show up in my community or for my community, I gladly refer and point individuals in different directions for services that they may need. So I welcome kind of those conversations and those emails too. Even if I can't be of service, I would like to be at least be able to point you in the right direction towards additional services.
Okay, well, that's awesome, and I really appreciate you for being a part of the show this evening, and sharing your insight about the state of Black consciousness in our community as you're able to see it from the work that you do right here in and around the Metro Detroit area. For people who are interested in some of the things that we were talking about, and you want to start to do your own research about some of the ideas that have been shared this evening, I want to give out a few books so that you can start your own studies. I'm going to give out three books, the first of which is called Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome by Joy DeGruy Leary. And I'm going to spell that middle name because it is a doozy. DeGruy Leary, Leary. Joy DeGruy Leary, Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome. The next book is The Falsification of African Consciousness by Dr. Amos N. Wilson. And the final book is The ISIS Papers by Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. All of these books are about Black psychology and psychoses and some of the issues that we have in our community that, as Patrice mentioned earlier, that we need to start having some open and honest conversations about so that we can start to heal ourselves from the trauma that, you know, not only that we have experienced directly, but the trauma of our ancestors that still lives on in us that, you know, has been repressed and we've not been able to bring out into the light of day and deal with it. So it's very important that we get to doing this work, because your mind is the way that you change your environment. You cannot change your reality for the better unless you change your mind for the better. So it's so important that we do this mental work, because you can't get into doing the true transformative work for your spirit if you're not dealing with the trauma that's kind of holding you back in your life. So once again, my name is Keith Young. This is Afro Perspectives on blogtalkradio.com. We do this every Sunday at 9 o'clock, and we're going to be having more guests that have insight into history, psychology, Afro-spirituality, decoding media and movies and things like that. So it's going to be fun. We're going to have some interesting things that we're going to be sharing. And once again, I do appreciate you for Patrice for coming on the show this evening and sharing that powerful information with us. Is there anything
Thank
else
you,
that you
I
would
appreciate.
Like to share before we close out the show?
Absolutely not, outside of just thank you for having me and giving me a platform to really just share. And I appreciate you having this conversation about mental health, because, again, as we talk more about mental health and just kind of make it a common part of our everyday conversation and a part of the things that we share with the community, will reduce a lot of that stigma. I see a lot of that going on right now in the different shows that we are watching, and we are trying as a community to try to break through the stigma, and we recognize that our mental health, our self-esteem, our esteem, being able to become healthy and self-actualized is really rooted in who we think we are. And I see a lot of people, yourself included, doing a lot of work in that space, and I'm just happy to be able to be a part of it as well. So thank you for allowing me to share today.
You're very welcome. It was great having you on the show this evening. That's a wrap, folks. We have talked to our star guest, Patrice Lucas, and Coffee with a Counselor. And I have learned a lot this evening. I hope that you have, too. And I hope to see you back here next Sunday at 9 o'clock. If you didn't get a chance to listen to the show live on blogtalkradio.com, you can always go to blogtalkradio.com/Afro Perspectives and download the shows. You can also download them via iTunes, their podcasting feature. So this information is going to be available for as long as we have access to the web and as long as we have access to things like iTunes and, you know, your smartphone and things like that. So if you can't get it live, hopefully you'll be able to get it on a download. If you found this information helpful, please share it with a friend. Let them know that, you know, we're out here sharing this type of information and that we have resources and things like that that can actually help you. So we're not, this is not a show where we're going to be talking about a lot of negativity or, you know, folks aren't going to be getting cussed out and fussed out and, you know, a lot of arguments. So it may not be as popular in the mainstream, but people who are actually trying to get some work done and make their lives better for themselves should find this show to be very interesting, enlightening, and empowering. So this is Keith Young for AfroPerspectives.com. Thanks again to my guest, Patrice Lucas. And that's a wrap, folks. I will see you on the next episode. Peace.